Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Chris Turner. Chris Turner made the very first professionally done documentary about reptilians called Don't Mention the Reptilians. He also put together the very first conference that was devoted exclusively to researchers who are focused on and familiar with the reptilian angle, the reptilian overlordship. He is a veteran videographer, veteran documentarian, and he's worked with a number of people over the years. He's been working a lot with Paul Sinclair. Paul was recently on the show to talk about the Bempton phenomena, what's going on in Bempton, a place in North Yorkshire, which to me sounds like a big vortex type area. Chris Turner is a documentary filmmaker who has been working in and around the alternative media for 10 years. He has met and interviewed many of the most recognized researchers in the alternative field, including David Icke, yours truly, Ellis Taylor, Paul Sinclair, and many others. So without any further ado, Chris Turner, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Hi, James. It's great to be here again. This is the second time I've been on the show, and I look forward to chatting about what I've been up to and hope that the listeners find it interesting.
The listeners will find it interesting, Chris, because I want the listeners to understand about who Chris Turner is, because bios and whatnot, they can only tell you so much about a person. I can tell you, dear listeners, as long as I've been in this field, over 30 years now, I can say that Chris is one of the most honest, sincere people who work from a basis and a standpoint of integrity, sincerity. He has an earnest desire to get this information out. And it takes a lot of work. It's a lot of work behind the scenes. I mean, we see the finished product. Those of you who've seen the Don't Mention the Reptilians documentary, and then the subsequent sequels that will come out later. So I just want people to understand that when you're talking about a Chris Turner, you're talking about one of the true pioneers in the field. To get started, Chris, can you tell us about how you got into this field and your approach to your research?
Well, that was very kind comments, James. Thank you for that. I think in relation to my approach, I think I would say that I was, whilst I do try to, stay focused and honest about what the stuff that I research and the people that I work with and the documentaries that I put out, a lot of that in the early days was based around naivety, if I'm honest. I came into this genre, if you like, with a sort of a warped perspective because I had come from working on mainstream television programs, only as from a visual effects perspective, of course. I used to work as a compositor for in Media City in Manchester as a freelancer, and I ended up working on programs like Doctor Who and Bedlam and Young Dracula, and some I did a lot of TV adverts. And that's really, I went back to university at the age of about 31 or 32, and with this, I had done some work in the alternative media briefly, but and I realised that in order to progress things, I would need some sort of qualification in regards to filmmaking. So I did a degree, got the job that I thought that I wanted in visual effects, TV and movies. And after, 5, 6, 7 months, I found myself just being part of the machine that I'd been talking about. I was sat at a desk, and the whole of the office, they were a good set of people. Nice people. But the minute we walked into work, it was, hello, how are you? How are the kids? And then the headphones went in and nothing was said until lunchtime. We had lunch, came back, and everybody put the headphones back in, and that was the day. It became mind-numbing. After the thrill of working on TV wore off, which didn't take long, I was coming home and I just said to my wife, I can't do this. I've made a big mistake. But I then realised that I had these qualifications. I'd met some people within visual effects and special effects. So that sort of networking is very useful in this in the alternative media, because there's absolutely no funding. So it was certainly worth it from that perspective. But it enabled me to get back into all the alternative genre, because I knew that YouTube was great, and there were a lot of, there was some fantastic stuff out. And I say it was, because we've got this whole censorship thing going on now with YouTube that they're literally deleting people's accounts and some of the more deep information you know, some of the researchers that I listen to, people like Freeman Fly, for example, they deleted his account. You know, I wasn't a fan of Alex Jones. I was in the old days, but regardless of what you think of Alex Jones, they should not have the power to just delete people. Well, effectively, they've deleted him from the internet. So it's a little bit like that film, The Net. Do you remember that film with Sandra Bullock, where they're just essentially able to just delete your profile from the online world? And that's the danger I see going forward with this filmmaking in the alternative media. And I think that's why, of late, I have been doing this, running this sort of, I'm in the infancy of it, but I'm really trying to start this campaign about filmmakers and researchers in the alternative community supporting one another. Because as the grip tightens from the machine and from the sensors, the information is going to literally disappear off the net. So we filmmakers, researchers, authors, you know, we are going to be forced down certain alleyways where that audience isn't as big. So I think now is the time to really try and support one another, whether it be a dollar or whether it be a like or a share on any social media platform. You know, I've said it before about they're a necessary evil as far as I'm concerned, places like Facebook. They're fantastic for networking. And I guess if you accept the fact that they are intrusive and that they're selling your data, among other things, you know, that's just part, it's just going to have to be part of the deal. We have to work with that. So, yeah, at the moment, I'm trying to really spread the word about the researchers that I've been working with, and I'm trying to support them by subscribing to the private radio shows or buying a book or sharing a link anywhere that I can. This, you know, I think that's come from the last 10 years of me struggling to do this and losing thousands of pounds. Everybody, I've realised that everybody must have been doing that. And that's no way, and you can sort of see why you would think that me 10 years ago, I thought the alternative media would be way in front of where it is now in terms of what it's putting out. But there's still no support there. And that's, you know, a lot of that is, don't get me wrong, I understand a lot of that is outside manipulation by these large companies, these tech companies, and these algorithms that are running to prevent the sharing of this information. And some of it, the problem is that some of it isn't. You know, years back when I was looking into David Icke's stuff, and we were looking at, you know, very dark, deep political, you know, the child abuse, paedophilia angles, I can understand why they would be targeting that. But they're also targeting the more fringe subjects like ufology and parts of ufology that we might consider quite tame. So I don't think that, you know, I don't think there's any boundaries. I think they've sort of made a line. They've drawn a line, and anything that is below the line is, you know, they're getting rid of it, however they can. So yeah, I mean that's where I'm at, and that's how I got into the alternative genre, really.
Now, since you brought it up, and we'll take a few minutes to talk about this, Chris, because it's an important point. There seems to be, for lack of a better term, this free lunch mentality amongst many of the people out there. Now, granted, there's always going to be trolls, in fact, hordes of trolls, some of whom are literally being paid to create disruption, chaos, cast aspersions, and mistrust upon certain people, let's say. But on the other hand, there seems to be this deep-seated Marxist-communist mindset where they demand everything for free. They don't take into account the amount of hours and the personal danger some of these investigators like yourself put yourself in, the places you go, the dangerous, perilous situations you find yourselves in at times. And I've been at the sharp end of the research field. And there's this mindset, Chris, where these are people who have no qualms paying $100 or $200 an hour to sit down with a lawyer or to go for a consultation to a medical professional in the allopathic medical field. But they scream bloody murder if you want to charge for a book or you want to charge for a lecture. Bernard Grunther was talking about how he spent hours and hours and days putting together a very long seminar, and he's charging $140 for it, and the trolls just come out of the woodwork and scream bloody murder. And I've given lectures where I speak for 4 hours plus, and I charge a lousy $40, Chris. And you break that down in hours. That's like a dollar. Rather, it's $10 an hour if you break it down per hour. And we've all sat through lectures where we paid $20, $30 for 45 minutes, an hour, 90 minutes, 75 minutes of absolute drivel. And I'm out there for 4 hours plus giving hardcore information. And people literally have come to my lectures expecting to get pension or discounts. People have trolled me and said, oh, you know, for $40, you ought to provide like a steak dinner and champagne along with that. It's like, Chris, there's this cultural Marxist free lunch mentality at work.
Yeah, absolutely. I never really noticed it at first. And I think, like you've said before, we've talked about this previously, a lot of that mindset, we know that sort of manipulation is what's responsible for the mindset of the majority of the people that just don't see what we see. And I guess you could say, if you was going to stretch it, that you have to have done it and experienced it to some degree to appreciate it. But I don't think, you know, that's what I used to think. I used to think, well, people probably don't understand how many hours such an author has put in this book. You know, this book has taken 2 years to write, and now you don't want to spend the $14.99 to buy the book. For what is considered, even by the guy, you know, that's mourning about purchasing the book, the truth, or an attempt at putting the truth out. Yet we hand over money to people like the BBC, who we know lie to us on a day-to-day basis. We just hand over the money and Sky, the same, and any of these packages in the mainstream. Like, you know, we just don't see what's going on. There's a total inversion going on. And that's why, I'll probably receive a lot of flack for this, but I'm hoping that, you know, people... I think most researchers, let's say, in the alternative field will know exactly what we're talking about. And I think for a long time, they may have been wary of speaking up and raising the point for fear of being jumped on by the trolls. But at some point, this has to stop because, as I said earlier, if we are going to be forced into certain alleyways and, you know, areas that we don't want to delve into, we're going to lose the audience that we do have on places like YouTube, unless we absolutely dilute the information. That's the only way, or subliminally, you know, play them at their own game and subliminally put this stuff out, or tie it up in some sort of fiction, which is what I tried to do a little bit, you know, without the budget in Don't Mention the Reptilians. And I'd still like to do that going forward. But, you know, I struggle to raise the money to just produce a documentary based on my travels around Britain. For a couple of years. So trying to produce a fictional account, you know, where you've got to pay actors and musicians and all the rest of it, costume and you name it, to do all that stuff, you know, it, at the moment, I just can't see it happening. So I really do hope that people start to support one another. And I'm not saying they're not at the moment. I think they are. I think another part of it, James, is that our audience, I think, we're not necessarily part of the machine, so we probably don't have that much cash expendable, if you know what I mean. And that's certainly what I've heard of some people, and I appreciate that. I know I get that. And in that case, you know, then just share the information. You know, just send it in an email, put it in a link, share it online, put it on Facebook, whatever it might be. But I think the qualms about people moaning about researchers getting paid. In fact, I can tell you, this is just my perspective. If I charge, when I put the documentary out and I put a fee on buying that documentary, I can guarantee you and anyone that buys that film that I will not be earning any money from it. I will barely be getting my money back. And that's the reality of it. I wish that wasn't true. And I hope going forward that we can somewhat make a profit, maybe. And maybe, you know, I mean, it's worthwhile from a personal perspective because this is what we want to do. You know, I decided to do this. I decided to commit to putting documentaries out and information out, sort of knowing that it wouldn't be the most lucrative endeavor that I ever committed to. However, that's only because we were allowing this external influence to stop it from happening. And I know everybody I speak to wants more content. They want to see more documentaries. They want to see better documentaries. They'd like to see independent TV shows made, whether that be online, which it probably would be. They'd like to see more radio shows being done. But yet, there's still this sort of, well, I haven't got the cash to pay for it, or I'm not willing to pay for it mentality. And that really needs to change. And that's not everybody. There's a lot of good people that do support us both. I think you probably agree with that.
Yes, and I'm thoroughly understanding of how some people, and I've been there, folks, where $5, $6, $7, $8 makes all the difference. That's the difference between getting to work tomorrow if you can, you know, put $2 or $3 into your gas tank, right? So yeah. I understand when people say, look, you know, I just, and they're apologetic, Chris, you know, that I have to just cancel my membership for a while. And I respect that because I've been there and I've been on the verge of being homeless. And I have an idea of what that dynamic is like. So as far as that goes, I have no qualms about that. And I have, you know, nothing but respect for the people who earnestly are interested in our information. It's the people that, you know, they know they don't have any interest in getting a subscription. They don't have any interest in sharing the information. All they want to do is just chirp and complain about how we're in it for the money. And for those of us who've given lectures, and people have heard me say this, but Dr. Carla Turner used to start her lectures back in the day with a joke about ufology. She said, three UFO researchers were on a Greyhound bus going through New Mexico. And the reason they're on a Greyhound bus is because they're UFO researchers and they can't afford plane tickets. Okay. That's how she started off her lectures. I kid you not, folks. And, you know, we would all laugh. But then I found out that, like, for example, every one of us who's given lectures can give you examples of how we travel to a location where a conference has taken place. And after lodging, after food, after travel, after expenses, and sometimes they don't even give us, these conference promoters, they don't even give us an honorarium, Chris. they give us the same kind of cheapskate, you know, socialistic mindset that, you know, so a lot of these people chirping about us give us. They say, oh, well, you know, even though they're making money off our efforts, they tell us, you need to do this, you know, because it's all about spreading the truth. It's all about, you know, doing what's right, right? And so we're expected to book travel, accommodations, food, all the incidentals, and all of that costs money. Go there, give our information, and sometimes what they try to do is record our lectures, videotape our lectures, turn around, and then you know, mass-produce DVDs and CDs, sell it. Okay. Now, this stuff happens all the time, folks. And then people chirp at us just because, you know, I'm charging $40 for a 4-hour lecture. You see, I mean, that's people, you have to treat, it's like if you're going to start a business, Chris, you treat it like a multi-million dollar business to begin with. You don't nickel and dime it from the beginning with this nickel and dime kind of mindset. Otherwise, the thing will never grow because you just create all these handicaps and all these hurdles in your mind. And from the perspective of the research you've done, and getting back to the research angle of it, Chris, give people an idea of the logistics involved. If you're going to do field work in the wilds of the UK, what it takes for you to do to get out there. And let alone, you know, like other people that have like workaday jobs, you know, 9-to-5 type jobs, they've got to take time off. They've got to go to these places. Give our listeners an idea of what it's like to do some field work.
Well, I think for a film like British Cryptids, which is the one I'm working on now, it's called Elusive British Cryptids. It's all about cryptids being sighted in the UK. So when I first came into it, I thought, well, this is going to be a relatively quick film in relation to the ones that I've done in the past. But as usual, my naivety soon came to a head. You know, I realized that if I was going to present this information and to do the witnesses justice, really, which was my main concern, because I'd met some witnesses that I'd never really experienced that with some of the one or two of the reptilian witnesses that I interviewed were, you could tell they were deeply traumatized, but I'd never met them face to face. I'd you know, we conversed over the internet, or I'd sent a cameraman to interview them, or, you know, we'd done it over Skype or whatever that might be. But with this investigation taking place in Britain, I had I was lucky enough to be face to face with a lot of these witnesses, and you could actually feel how that event, that sighting, had really affected some of them. And it was at that point I realised that, you know, a 3-month research project in a film is not going to do this thing justice. How am I going to present this information as, you know, I say fact, based on a 3-month investigation? And with Britain, I mean, people think Britain is small, and they only think it's small in relation to huge countries like Australia, America, Canada, and Russia. It's still, if you're walking the ground, you know, and you travel into Scotland and all the countries, the Wales and Ireland, trying to do this research, you're going to have to get on the ground, and you're going to have to trek to a lot of these places on foot. So that means that you're not going to be able to do your freelance work. You're going to have to get out and travel for days. And a thing about a documentary as well is, I've said this in previous interviews, if I travel to Scotland, for example, a place notorious for its bad weather, and I'm there to interview someone on in a certain region, all this stuff is being done outdoors. If the weather turns and it's horrendous, we can't film. So it gets cancelled for a day. So I check in to the hotel for another day. If it gets cancelled again, I check in for another day. And that's how these costs start mounting up. And then you've got your travel back and forth to these places. And of course, all the time you're working on this documentary, you're not freelancing, you're not earning any money to live, you know, effectively. And I guess I'm lucky that I've got a wife who really supports me, and she believes in the research, and she believes in the work that I do. And I know this, it sort of comes off like I'm mourning about it, but I'm just trying to give it a perspective. Not only about, this is not just a financial perspective. I guess what it's allowed me to do is meet other researchers that are doing exactly the same thing, and authors that are doing all the research on the ground, being out there and then traveling to these remote places, wild camping in these places, and then going home and writing about this for days and days on ends, you know, in order to put this information out in a book format, say. So it really opened my eyes to the amount of effort that, I mean, I guess you could even relate this to some of the mainstream things we see that work on this same basis. You know, there is a lot of work, and I think that's why a lot of these mainstream TV programs do have enormous budgets, for that very reason, that, you know, this is, not only is it consume your cash, it consumes a huge amount of your time and time with your family. And I guess you could class that as an expense, really, because, you know, there are times when I've been sat out in the pouring rain while camping somewhere, and I'll be thinking, what the hell am I doing in this wood alone on my own when I could be at home with my family? Do you know? And it is, you know, I do laugh about that now. But it was actually, it's part of filmmaking, and it is exciting. You know, I consider myself quite fortunate to be able to do what I do. You know, I think having been through, you know, I don't think I could ever go back to working a 9-to-5 job. When you've, you know, and it's not just the information that prevents me from doing that, knowing that I just wouldn't feel comfortable, you know, being part of the machine. Not in every profession, just some professions that I'd worked in previously. But I just, you know, I love doing this stuff, and it is hard work, but it's also exciting at times. And, you know, I'm hoping, you know, that one day some of this stuff that I get to research about, you know, cryptids and UFOs and aliens and all the paranormal supernatural things, you know, I have had one or two experiences, but I'm always, as an investigative filmmaker, I'm looking for that, you know, that moment on camera, really. And I guess I probably shouldn't say that, because people say, oh, well, you know, if you go out to film that and you're going out to film one of these cryptids, that'll never happen. But it doesn't, you know, people who watch documentaries, you know, I think that's really what they're looking for, isn't it? They're looking for that piece of evidence. They're looking for that thrill in the documentary. And that's really what I aspire to do in these films.
And people need to be open-minded too, because we live in the digicam era. We live in the camcorder era. We live in the mobile phone camera era. And even before we got to this stage, people were getting all kinds of photographic images of aliens, like places in Latin America. Jaime Masson, the great Mexican UFO researcher, he heads up the 60 Minutes show in Mexico. Yeah. People over the years have sent him many pictures of aliens in the background. There's like a couple there, and it's dusk or dark, and they're mugging for the camera, and the picture is taken, and lo and behold, there's an ET walking behind them. You know, I mean, things like that happen. So, you know, because the knee-jerk response, Chris, is, oh, well, this video of this alien or this Bigfoot or this dogman is so good, then of course it must be a hoax. So, you know, it's like you can never satisfy some of these people.
Yeah, it really is. And that's, again, it's something that I didn't foresee coming into this. I mean, I should have done coming back, you know, from you know, that the research in the reptilian stuff, I should have seen that coming. You know, I don't know whether I ever sent you that, the image of the a lady in the US sent me a frame from a video that she recorded from a, she was recording a video to a partner who worked out on the oil rigs. She was doing it on an iPhone, you know, the FaceTime. And she was recording that and then sending that across via email. She couldn't get a live link to this oil rig. So when she sent the video, when he watched it back, eventually when he received it, he noticed this. What I can only imagine is either an alien or a demon or a djinn or something of that description in the background. And have you ever seen that picture?
No, please send it to me. I'd like to check it out.
I'll send you that. Yeah, it is a bizarre. It is absolutely bizarre. And when I put that out, you know, I did have one or two comments saying, wow, that's amazing. But for the most part, the people were just jumping on that saying, you've either faked that or it's just distortion. And it really isn't. You really have to see this. You know, it's on, if you view my Facebook profile, or if you go on, I think I am going to upload that to Don't Mention the Reptilians website. It's, you know, it is a crazy image. It's probably one of the best I've ever seen, actually. Although it is distorted because it's from a phone, you can actually, this is very clear. You can make out this, the head of this whatever this thing is. It's very frightening. And along with the account that she sent me, she was a MyLab, an abductee, all the stuff from the reptilian film. She's had all these encounters since childhood. You know, I guess a general abductee experiences, if you want to call it that, or an experience, as an experience. I never know really how to, you know, some people get offended on how you refer to them, an experiencer or a contactee or an abductee. So I'm very careful about and cautious how I say that. Yeah, but that's exactly what happened there. So, and with my background being in visual effects as well, I do get that thrown at me now and then. Oh, well, it would be easy for you to fake something. You know, and that's quite insulting, really, for anyone. I guess these people don't know me, really. So I shouldn't really be that offended. And for the most part, I think we have to remember that these are the same people that are not really interested in what we're doing.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Because, for example, secreted away in a number of facilities all over the place, there are bona fide, 100% valid film imagery going back to the 1940s of aliens, of recovered alien craft, et cetera, of living aliens even. And so, I mean, if we were to suddenly show that out on YouTube or whatever, there's going to be hordes of people complaining about that, even though it came from one of these secret facilities somewhere. I mean, they exist. And the thing about it is when they show these videos to each other or these films or these pictures, think of all the gun camera film of UFO intercepts of these jet fighters and fighter planes, even back to the propeller days, intercepting these UFOs and chasing after them, just the miles and miles and miles of gun camera footage. That wasn't hoaxed. I mean, it's out there. It exists. But just because it shows something that's unequivocal and something that is absolutely crystal clear, well, you know, someone's always got to complain about something, Chris. Now getting back to the Bigfoot-type research, in Britain, there have been a number of reports over the years of Bigfoot-type creatures. Could you give us a thumbnail history of what the Bigfoot situation in the UK has been like?
Well, when I came into this, I wasn't aware of it. And if you ask me how I got into this genre, cryptids, particularly, I mean, the British Bigfoot? I have absolutely no idea. I can't even recall how I came to get in touch with a lady called Deborah Hatswell. And she runs the British Bigfoot research team here. And Deborah's history is that she, when she was 15, this is about 35 years ago, she saw what she described as, you know, we call it Bigfoot, but in Britain, they're traditionally known as the Wood Wars or the Green Man. I mean, often you'll see in the churches here in Britain, you'll see the face of a man peering out of the leaves, and that, you know, he's often referred to as a nature spirit or the Green Man, we really know him as. So obviously, after she'd had this sighting, after she'd gotten over it, because she spent a long time, years, in fact, after that sighting, she actually moved to high-rise accommodation. She was that traumatized by what she'd seen. She was skipping school. She was playing truant from school with a friend of hers, and they had gone to this park, and they were just sat on the park, just laughing and giggling and just having fun generally, when they heard a noise, and they assumed that it was going to be a teacher that had come to find them, or one of the parents, you know, why not at school? And the next thing, she just turned and looked and saw this huge face, this face staring at her out of this bush with a massive jaw, a huge muscular head. And she, now today, she describes it as, you know, as a Bigfoot. I mean, it's the only sort of reference that she had. I mean, I know it's a reference to something that was seen in Canada and in North America, but that's the best she had. So she obviously went on to research the history of this stuff in Britain, and that's where she came upon the legends of the Wood Wolves. And of course, you know, this is not just Britain either. I mean, this sort of stuff goes over to Europe as well, because of course, about 8,000 years ago, we were joined to Europe. You know, Doggerland, it was called. We were joined to Europe, and then when the floods came, it was all separated. So these accounts are still coming into this day from all over Europe and all, as well as, you know, it's just not documented. You know, this, I think for the most part, because most of the research comes from massive countries, as I said previously, like Australia, Canada, and America. These are enormous places. So you can actually see how a flesh and blood upright cryptid, some say a primate, might be there, but people, you know, really have a hard time believing that, you know, that's the case here in Britain because of its size. But having spent the last 2 years trekking around Britain, I can tell you that it really isn't a small place. I think that's what I would say. It's just not a small place, and it's not as small as everyone thinks it is. That's what I've learned. So yeah, there are a lot of accounts, and in fact, Deborah's work over the past 35 years, she worked with a number of researchers, Ian Jennings, Adam Bird, Kat Jenkins, Neil Young, and they put this map together. She first started off really old school, you know, using pins on a paper map, you know, back just after a sighting. And she started gathering these sightings, and then she started to get in touch with people. And they started, as technology grew, she started to put it on Google, along with the help of these other researchers, started to put this information on this digital map. And if you type in to Google British Bigfoot map sightings, you'll see that there are now over 500 sightings on that map that you can, each one is listed. You just click on it and it'll give you the information about that sighting. And most of these sightings are given in the witnesses' words as well, which is what's interesting. And even that in itself came back as, well, you know, from some skeptics, you're making these up. You're making these accounts up just randomly without any evidence, with no proof whatsoever. I mean, you know, what she had been demonized as a 15-year-old. You know, she was bullied at school after this event. For what reason would you then want to scream and shout about it from the rooftops, you know, into early adulthood? You know, very similar to, you know, experiences of alien contact go through the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. You know, there's this mentality that, oh, you want to be famous and you want attention, and it's just nonsense. And yes, I accept there are people like that around, but for the most part, the people that I meet, the people that I've spoken to, and you will know better than I, you've been doing this a lot longer, that's just not what people do. So why that is used as a stick to beat people with, you know, the hoaxing stick. And there isn't even a hoaxing culture over here in Britain. I guess in parts of Canada and America, I guess in relation to Bigfoot, yes, one or two hoaxes have happened. But in Britain, there's no culture of Bigfoot. There's mythology and some history of it, but it's not a widely known phenomenon. You know, when people see me out researching, or they might see me wearing one of the t-shirts with a logo on, you know, they're genuinely like baffled as to what I'm talking about. They actually look at me like I'm crazy, and at times I think I wonder whether I am camping out there in the wild. But you know, this is why it's such an interesting area, and it's such. You know, I wasn't aware of it, and I'm someone that's been in the alternative genre for like 10, 12 years now, and I hadn't heard of cryptids in Britain. And I think it may be just that simple. I just hadn't heard of it, and maybe that's why I found it a little bit harder to gain traction in putting the information out. Maybe that's what it is. Because I mean, were you aware of Bigfoot in Britain, James?
Honestly, Chris, now that you mention it, no, because my focus had always been riveted on the U.S. and California, Oregon, Canada, and then, you know, throughout the Midwest and the East Coast. And, you know, there's Bigfoot-type reports all over the U.S. And also in Australia, we have reports of they call them the Yowies, you know, is one of the names they give them. So it never occurred to me that there would be Bigfoot and other cryptids running around the U.K. But when you look at it from an energetic standpoint, Chris, and how long civilization has been there, and the fact that it is such a large country and so much of it is still essentially uncharted, trackless, black as pitch at night. And I've been in some of these places at night, and you cannot see your hand in front of your face. And that's what people have to understand. When they think of England, they think of London, they think of Manchester. They don't think of just all the wilds that are out there. Now, can you tell us about some of the other witness accounts you've heard of the Bigfoot type creatures and the scenarios that these people found themselves in?
Yeah, well, I don't know whether did Paul Sinclair mention the account that he had from the guy that was living in Australia?
No, I don't think he talked about that.
Yeah, what happened? This gentleman had purchased his book, Truth Proof. That's Paul's first book. And obviously, Paul does a lot of research on the Flixton werewolf, which is in over in East Yorkshire. So this guy had read his account and had contacted Paul about something that happened to him before he moved to Australia. This guy used to live in Britain, and he was in the woods with his friends just camping. They were kids. I think this is back in the either the early 90s or late 80s. And they were all out here in the woods, and they'd lit this fire, as you do. And they weren't seasoned campers. They were just kids. We've all done it. We just spent the night out in the woods. And they were all, this is late in the night. It was probably in the early hours, and they'd all nodded off. And this guy said, before he knew it, his friend, he opened his eyes, and all he could hear was his friend screaming in terror. And he looked, I mean, obviously the fire is dimmed at this point, but there's still some light, and all he can see is his friend being hung upside down 3 feet off the ground by his calf.
And Crikey. You can see
it's an incredible account. And I think that the events surrounding it, the fact that this guy had contacted him from Australia, and it, you know, and it's the same MO, they're always very nervous, they don't want to go public, because obviously I wanted this guy in the film, but he didn't want to do it, understandably. And he said all he could see was this huge arm, this muscular, hairy arm, this powerful arm, had hold of this kid by the calf muscle. And I say kid, I think this guy was probably about, you know, between, he was a teenager, late teenager, maybe 17, 18. And he was quite a big lad as well. He was known as the tough one out of the group. And this guy was absolutely screaming in terror. And so obviously it wasn't long before everybody was screaming in terror. And eventually this, whatever it was, just dropped him like a stone to the floor. And they heard this crashing as it ran off into the trees. So as you can imagine, pandemonium just took place then, and they were in utter panic. They just really didn't know what to do because they didn't want to leave the area. They had lights. I mean, they were quite in quite a remote part of the woods, so they didn't want to attempt leaving because they didn't, you know, it's that scenario where if we wander off into the dark now in a panic, we're all going to split up, and there's a fear that it's going to get one of us because that's just the way you're going to think. So what they did is they built the fire up as big as they could get it. Any wood or any trees and bits of branches, they just threw it on the fire to create as much light as possible until the morning came, until the sun came up, really. And I think they had about an hour of peace and quiet. And then, again, all of a sudden, they started hearing noises and trees and clicking. You know, that clicking noise that they're renowned for making. And they started then hearing these noises from different directions. And then, obviously, there was more than one of these things. And this sort of continued, the crashing in the trees from all directions. Basically, they just wanted these kids out of the area. They didn't want them lighting fires. And that's what I get from this encounter. They just didn't want these kids there. And eventually, the sun came up, and whatever these creatures were, disappeared. And these kids would just ran and got out of there as fast as possible. And I think that's really an amazing account, really, because it's one of the few accounts where there's been physical contact, where one of these creatures has actually, I mean, it could have done a lot worse. I think that goes to show that I think that the Wood Wasp or the Wild Man or the Bigfoot, whatever you want to call it, is not necessarily known for being, you know, aggressive without reason. For the most part, what they generally do is warn people out of the area. And I think that's exactly what they were doing in this encounter. And, you know, that's a physical encounter, but there are peculiar, also very peculiar encounters as well. I think there's one where there was a girl at home and her parents had gone out, and she was chatting on the phone to a friend. And I think this was summertime. The back door was open. And she's just chatting away on the phone to a friend. And she looks up, and in the doorway of the open doorway of the kitchen is this huge, hairy, bipedal, upright creature. And it had to dip and duck under the doorframe to lean in. And she said it was almost like it was wondering who was talking, who's making the noise on the phone. And they sort of locked eyes for 5 or 6 seconds. And you can imagine that was probably quite a long 5 seconds. And she was just, she couldn't speak. She just sat there in absolute terror. She actually described it as looking a little bit like Chewbacca. Because again, what we do, we jump to references, don't we? Familiar references.
Yes, we do.
And she actually described its hair as like a light brown blondy color. Very similar, I guess, to Chewbacca, you would say. And that's another thing that comes out. These cryptids, these whatever people are seeing over here in Britain, they do come in, you know, some of them are really dense hair, black, thick, dense hair. And in this case, it had really quite light, thin, blonde, mousy-coloured hair. But again, it was enormous. It had to dip. And, you know, that begs the question, you know, which I totally understand the sceptics then say, well, wait a minute, Chris, what are you saying here? Are you saying that we have a troop, potentially thousands of these, what can only be described as 6 to 8 feet creatures roaming around the UK, which is relatively small in comparison, and no one's reporting this? I mean, this sounds a little bit crazy, Chris. I mean, are you sure? Are you sure about this? All I can do is meet the witnesses, and these guys are genuinely seeing this stuff. So that obviously begs the question, and it's the same debate that's going on over in Canada, Russia, and America, is this a flesh and blood creature? You know, what are we dealing with here? You know, and you get into then the realms of the supernatural, don't you? Because I think if you've worked around the alternative media, and you've worked in ufology, and you're familiar with the techniques that the aliens use to shapeshift, for want of a better word, or use mind control techniques, or the jinn. I've talked about the jinn before. The jinn of Eastern law, They have that ability. The fairies from, you know, from Ireland, the Celtic legends. What are we dealing with here? Are we dealing with maybe something like a fairy or a djinn that is presenting itself in this form and you're just thinking it's a flesh and blood animal? Or is it actually something that is here in the UK and it lives in the remote places in, I don't know, say Scotland, which is probably the best place that it could possibly live if it was indeed a flesh and blood animal? But even then, myself, as over this 2 years, I have found myself siding with some of the skeptics, actually, because when I actually consider what they're saying, it is difficult to see that these things might not have been captured in the numbers, if you think about it. You know, Britain over the years has had a lot of deforestation and a lot of severe farming as well, where the habitat would have been actually stripped back. So you have to ask yourself the question, if they're here, then why aren't they being reported more? And why isn't there a solid history? Why aren't they logged in the British fauna, for example? Why aren't they considered part of, you know, British wildlife? Similar to, again, the Sasquatch accounts. And that's really where I found myself now, is really looking into the supernatural angle of this. Because I think, as a researcher, you have to follow the evidence. You have to go where the evidence takes you. And the evidence, you know, off the back of this, you do start to look at the statistics around the available land, which is really important. I probably should talk a little bit about that, because that's a key ingredient here in this whole debate about the flesh and blood Bigfoot. There isn't enough land, Chris. As you just mentioned, there is this idea about Britain that it's very small and it's somewhat of a concrete sort of city. And there's very few green spaces over here. And that's just not true. I think Andy McGrath's been on the show, hasn't he, before?
Yes, he has.
The percentages of urban environment in England, it's only 10%. I think in Scotland, it's as little as 1.9% of Scotland is considered urban. Now, that's crazy, really. You know, from an outsider, when I heard that, even someone, you know, as a resident of Britain, when I heard that statistic, I was like, wow, that's incredible. And then I flipped back to, well, maybe there is space for this flesh and blood creature, because we don't know how many there are. You know, there are a number of questions that skeptics throw, and they're all valid. Don't get me wrong. I have such indecision about what my thoughts. I'm constantly flipping back and forth as to whether this thing is real. And I say real in the corporeal form, I say. That's what I mean. Is it, or is it just supernatural, interdimensional? Because that's, you know, a reality that we have to consider when you look at the mythology and you look at things like the fairies and the djinn, because that's exactly what they are. They're presenting themselves as things that look corporeal and they look flesh and blood, like, you know, you could touch them. But, and that's exactly what these witnesses are describing. So it's a real debate here. And there is an organization called the CFC, that's the Center for Fortean Zoology, that's been around a long time here. And that's headed by a guy called John Downes. And he's a cryptozoologist. And he is adamant about there just not being enough space in this country, as are the rest of that organization. They're trained, you know, zoologists that really argue that there's just no way that a creature that size could survive here undetected. And then it flips again, because they talk about this thing being undetected and unreported, when that's just not true. You're finding these witnesses find themselves in a really tricky situation, because where do you report seeing a 7-foot bipedal hairy man? It comes described as a troll. I mean, that's a Scandinavian term, but some of these witnesses described it as looking like a troll. Again, that reference point. So they talk about this like it's not being reported. And there's around 550 sightings now. So it is being reported. And then you get to thinking, is this exactly the same as alien abduction research, where there must be a huge amount of people that are too frightened to talk about this stuff? And I know, and you'll know, that when you do conferences and you get to speak to people alone And in certain environments, they will open up about their accounts. But for the most part, they're not going to report it to the police. I mean, we have, don't get me wrong, we have done freedom of information requests from the police. And we've had some very interesting results come back. And also some very suspicious results come back, like, you know, you're not privy to this information because it comes from before 1974 and those files have been destroyed. Now, we know that that's just not true. But how do you combat that? So it is, and there's only a handful of us researchers trying to find this information as well, which is a big thing. So that whole supernatural flesh and blood argument will rage forever and ever. What are your thoughts on that, James?
Well, I kind of go down the middle, Chris, because I've heard enough eyewitness firsthand reports about Sasquatch or whatever name people of a given region give these beings. And some of them, not all, but some of them seem to manifest metaphysical capabilities. They seem to be able to speak telepathically. They can appear in the dreams of people. They can make things manifest in midair. They can gift people things like marbles and things where they can just make these things appear in midair and just drop to the ground. And they can do all kinds of things as far as sounds, knocking sounds. Mike Patterson, who I've had on the show, he talks about, he was living not in the outskirts, but kind of, near the outskirts of an urban area. And he was still having these visitations from these interdimensional Sasquatch. And on the other hand, I do believe, and when I say interdimensional, what I mean by that is, some of them have the ability to alter their density. They can be physical, corporeal, where you can touch them and they can touch you. But like other beings, they seem to have the ability to alter their density and become invisible. And they seem to be able, at least some of them, to utilize this worldwide portal system where they can suddenly just manifest out of a portal opening and just pop up right in front of you in the woods. And people have talked about how they've been in a hide site, like a hunter or something. And then they look down and then they see a huge Sasquatch walking along, bright flash of blue light. And then the Sasquatch is gone. Like it just disappeared. So some of them have manifested, not all. And I kind of think in relative terms, to here on Earth with humans, where, some people are relatively spiritually, physically, intellectually evolved, and, all political correctness aside, some people and some entire cultures are not. That's just the way it is. That's just, that's just a fact. Some people and some cultures are simply not at the level of others. And I think that's going on, and that's not a criticism of some of these other Sasquatch type races or groupings. I do believe that some of them can be quite aggressive, and they've been known, and the Native Americans talk about this, of they've had battles with some of the more aggressive Sasquatch in the Sierra Nevada mountains in California and other places where the Sasquatch tribes there seem to be on the more aggressive side. And we're still having stories to this day of military units being ambushed and attacked by these aggressive Sasquatch, and they're shooting at the Sasquatch, and all these battles ensue. But really, that's just kind of a modern version of what the Native Americans talked about. So I think it runs the gamut, Chris. Some are very peaceful. Some are very spiritually evolved. And some even seem to have an ET connection, where they've been seen to go in and out of, landed ships or ships hovering, not too high in the sky. They can, be floated up or down into a craft, and people have been in craft and seen Sasquatch type beings with what we would call ETs. So I think it runs the gamut. I think it really does.
Yeah, I think you're right. There are accounts here in the UK of them being seen on craft. The Bigfoots, these hairy bipedal upright walking creatures have been seen in some of these ET abduction encounters. So, I mean, and that only sort of muddies the water for someone like me who's trying to present all this thing in some sort of, I don't know, logical order. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times the edit has changed when I thought I had a handle on exactly what was going on. And I speak to someone like Paul Sinclair, for example, who's dealing with witnesses that are seeing everything you've mentioned there, from, you know, supernatural type creatures to dogmen or werewolf. The traditional name for it would be a werewolf here in Britain. And that's really, I guess a lot of this is from my looking into the reptilian stuff. I wondered, okay, if these things are flesh and blood, which is unlikely, but if they are, I have to consider it and I have to do, you know, I have to present the evidence. What would happen if, when this deforestation happened, or when these cataclysmic events happened in the past, for example, what does civilization do? It retreats underground. So yes. Is that what happened? I mean, there's a lot of assumption going on here, and that's just a wild theory. But I'm just going off history, really, just basing it on what's happened in the past with our cultures. Traditionally, we just retreat underground, and animals retreat underground. And that's why I was looking. That's why I've been saying in the past that we need skilled people in the British Bigfoot team researching who are familiar with geology, with scientific training on biology, dendrology, you know, to the study of trees. Because, you know, I remember reading about, you'll probably know about this, the reptilian city at the Grand Canyon that those two tourists yes. happened to find yes. themselves in. And I wonder, has that ever happened here? I mean, you know, there is talk, and we'll get to that shortly, about underground either military or alien bases here in Britain. You know, this is not a new thing. And are they taking advantage of natural caverns? Are those things, do they exist here? Or does the geology not, you know, support that? I don't know. I don't know anything about geology. And that's why, you know, I can't say definitively one way or another, but I have to acknowledge these theories.
Yes. Please continue.
And I have to acknowledge that the skeptics have got really valid arguments, and I wouldn't be doing the film justice or myself justice if I didn't listen to them and, you know, present the facts that a lot of this information is difficult to take in, particularly the flesh and blood, because of the scientific arguments against it. You know, yes. You can get into the whole fossil argument, can't you, about where are the skeletons? Where are the bodies? I mean, this stuff, I mean, in America and these huge expanses of land, I mean, you can fly for hours and hours in Russia and Canada and America and Australia even without seeing anybody or anything. So I guess you could say, well, that's why we're not finding the bodies, because these things perhaps are like elephants and they go to die off in remote places. But here in Britain, can I say that? Can I be truthful and really argue that point? I'm struggling, if I'm honest, to do that.
Well,
the only argument I can find is the underground. That's the only thing.
That's exactly what I was thinking, Chris, and I just didn't mean to talk over you. But
no, you're right.
When you were saying earlier about where these zoologists types were saying, well, where would they be? I mean, you know, with deforestation being what it is, you know, where could they hide in a place with a finite amount of land? Point taken, but there's also the underground aspect, the tunnel systems, the cavern systems, and we must remember that not all tunnel entrances are physical. Some of these, again, it delves, and this is where we're probably going to lose some of these flesh and blood, you know, dogmatic zoologist types, is some of these portal entries are energetic, they're metaphysical in nature, where to you and I, it would seem like solid rock, but for beings with the know-how, they can manifest a portal entry and walk right through it, right? And it's all just a question of vibration and frequency. Also, the lore in the UK is rife with stories of the wee folk, the little people, the gentry yeah. living in the grottos, living in the rocks, living in caves. So even in the folklore of the UK and Scotland, the concept of beings and entire civilizations living underground, that's well established. Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment. We've got so much more to share. Chris, can you tell our listeners what your website is and your YouTube channel and how they can reach you?
Yeah, if you go onto YouTube and you type in Chris Turner Cryptids and Mysteries, that's my YouTube channel. Just type in Chris Turner, or the documentary is called Elusive. If you type that in, you'll come up with the search results. If you type in Don't Mention the Reptilians, that will come up. My website is don'tmentionthereptilians.com. That probably needs updating, because I'm going to talk later on a little bit about the sequel to Don't Mention the Reptilians, which is due out early next year.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to that one. And correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but were you considering also doing a documentary about My Labs and deep black military operations in relation to ETs?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I found with the reptilian documentary. And I found exactly the same thing here with the cryptid research. There are so many facets of this that are seemingly not connected, but must be. It really is. Each of these subjects, again, in a 90-minute film or an 80-minute documentary, you can't present all the information that you would like to. It's just impossible. I mean, you and I know you do four-hour lectures, and you probably feel like you don't even scratch the surface.
Oh, yes. I feel like that every time.
Yeah. And it's the same with filmmaking. I mean, a lot of you do find yourself diluting things. And I'm a context-based editor as well. So even though I should probably modernize my editing style, because I really want to put the information across and not do an Ancient Aliens type edit, where in the 42 minutes that you watch the show, they could have really put it in 5 minutes. And you know, you're not really, I mean, I like Ancient Aliens, don't get me wrong. I think there've been some great episodes, and I like some of the researchers on there. And I'm sure that they would agree with me that I wish that they would present my information a little bit better than they are doing. You know, people like Dolan and Hatcher, who's the guy from Birmingham that goes on, I can't remember his name, Nick Redfern. You know, they all have amazing information to share, but these guys are really cut down to small snippets of information that essentially are all saying the same things. And there's this modern style of editing now that everything, if you notice modern TV now, it's like 4 second camera angle changes in 4 seconds. Everything, you may not have noticed, but just have a look at it now when you watch it. Every 4 seconds, 5 seconds, the angle changes, and that's because of the attention span. They're trying to keep you constantly fixated on the screen in a visual way, not in an intellectual way where you're audibly listening to this stuff and taking it in. And that's where I differ with my edits, because that's what the whole idea is, to get the information out there. And if you can make it look fancy, which I try and do when you are out and about and you are using amazing transitions and drone footage, which I can do. But for the most part, you've got to make it engaging from a context perspective. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm trying to always represent the witnesses as well.
And you've done a great job, Chris. Okay, we've reached the end of our first segment with our guest, Chris Turner. All our listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the start of the member segment.